very good morning to everyone. The first case this morning is number 054558, In Re Emerald Casino Incorporated, the appeal of the Village of Rosemont. Mr. Goroff.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning, and may it please the Court, Counsel. I'm David Goroff, Foley and Lardner, on behalf of the Village of Rosemont, the appellant. This appeal is brought to enforce a confirmed Chapter 11 plan of reorganization in bankruptcy. The confirmation and enforcement of a plan is a core proceeding under 28 U.S.C. Section 157. It is also within the bankruptcy court's exclusive in rem jurisdiction, something that has been entrusted to the federal courts since the founding of our republic. This appeal is also brought to enforce a plan that was finally and formally approved by the Illinois Gaming Board, which I'll call the IGB sometimes, as the plan under which the IGB will proceed. It follows a course of conduct in which the IGB was integrally involved in each aspect of the plan, culminating in its what I call the IGB plan resolution, a formal vote on July 28, 2004, to approve the plan.
Mr. Goroff, let me ask you a question that may sound a little bit far afield. Do you think that if the city of Chicago entered into an agreement with the Latin Kings that it would not enforce the drug laws in a certain neighborhood in Chicago, that would be an enforceable agreement?
That it would not enforce federal drug laws?
Any drug laws, state drug laws, federal drug laws.
I think it would depend on the context. I think that there is an ongoing police power in the example you give, Judge Wood, which isn't here in our case, where you have the resolution of a pre-existing single piece of litigation involving a single subject, Emerald Casino.
Well, but let me just say then. So you, I want to first understand your answer to my question, which. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're reluctant to say that the city could conclusively contract away its authority to enforce its police power, to use its police powers to enforce properly.
I think it's true that the city sitting today couldn't for the future say, we'll never exercise police powers in any given instance vis-a-vis anyone who might ultimately join the Latin Kings or any other street gang.
And apart from an actual plea bargain in a prosecution, which could happen, as we know, in that instance, a prosecutor can say, we're not going to hold you for crime A. Instead, we're going to charge you only for crime B. Cities don't, you can't bind in the future even the next day somebody from deciding that a prosecution should be brought until it's been embodied in some valid plea bargain accepted by a court.
Or a consent decree, Your Honor, would be another example.
Well, I'm focusing on the police power, you know, the criminal side of things. Because, of course, as you recognize, the reason I'm asking this is the disciplinary proceeding that is one of the things that, it, you know, sort of maybe the thing at issue before us was, in a regulatory sense, the exercise of the police power of the state of Illinois, was it not?
When it began, it was, Your Honor, but recall...
Why did it morph into something that wasn't the police power? What you have to argue, and what I'm having trouble seeing in the plan, is some binding commitment on the part of the state of Illinois, through its Attorney General and the Gaming Board, to drop whatever disciplinary proceedings existed.
Well, if you look at Section 5.10 of the plan...
I've looked at all those sections of the plan.
Well, it provides for a payment to the state of what amounts to hundreds of millions of dollars.
But it didn't happen.
Well, it didn't happen because the state caused the failure of its own promise. You can't, through the breach of your contract, avoid the contractual obligation.
But the state never promised, the Attorney General in particular...
Well, the Attorney General
promised not to resume the disciplinary proceeding. And even the bankruptcy judge, Judge Weedoff, notes that there was some risk that the disciplinary proceeding would resume.
By the Attorney General.
So what's why it, not? Because what's wrong with the Attorney General as the enforcing official in the state of Illinois?
Well, as Your Honor knows from your King v. Walters decision, generally it's heads of departments who have the ability to resolve litigation on behalf of their agencies. The disciplinary proceeding was resolved by way of settlement through the plan.
Well, we don't know that. The plan has qualifying language that does not show up in your brief. The plan keeps saying, subject to the following conditions. For example, that December 2003 letter, subject to the following conditions.
And those conditions had all failed at the time that the gaming board came before the court and said, despite the failure of these conditions, we embrace the plan.
But the attorney general, interestingly, did not agree with that letter. The gaming board had no authority to speak for the attorney general.
But the attorney general, the gaming board, represented to the court, and again, this King v. Walters is an important analogy, that they were the body that had authority to speak for the state.
Why is that binding on the bankruptcy court? That's a question of law.
Well, it's a question of law, but there's no reason to look beyond it. No one has ever said here, there's been no finding, that the attorney general was the proper entity to speak for the state. The gaming board, and you see in the attorney in the state's briefs that all of the powers they say at page 4 of their brief, that the gaming board has the power to enforce disciplinary proceedings. And what the binding majority of the gaming board said at the confirmation hearing was that they and not the attorney general had the authority.
But this is just testimony of members of the board. It seems to me if you had a bunch of congressmen all standing up and bemoaning, you know, the budget deficit and saying, you know, we should never do that, that may be very interesting. But until Congress passes a budget that doesn't have a deficit, it's so many words.
And that's exactly what the gaming board did. On July 28th, they issued a formal resolution. And at the end of the year, under Illinois law, the gaming board is required to give an audit report to the governor of its final actions of the year. For 2004, and it's at our appendix at 542, they wrote, on August 3, 2004, the board voted 3-1 to approve a revised plan of reorganization for the Isle of Capri to purchase Emerald.
But then,
that's
of course,
a final order.
As you well know, the question there is one of timing. The language in the plan to which you refer, in your view, is simply a blank check for the gaming board to do anything whatsoever after the plan is confirmed and make that binding on the bankruptcy court. So this resolution, or they could say, oh, we've changed our mind, we're going to give it back to Emerald. They could have said anything on your word, on your reading of it, and it would have had to have been enforced.
No, that's not true, Your Honor.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
Obviously, you can't, at the confirmation hearing, have a formal vote taken pursuant to the Open Meetings Act.
No, but you see what I'm saying? There was language in the plan that said, more or less, you know, the plan has to be implemented and actions taken after the plan necessary for its implementation have to be enforced and so on and so forth.
Of course.
But under your reading, anything that the board did, anything that anyone did afterwards, has to be enforced.
I don't have to go that far, Your Honor. Well, all I'm talking about is the IGB plan resolution here and the letter agreement of August 2nd, 2004.
I know it, but what
they
I'm saying is once the condition has failed, as you concede it had, as of the date of the confirmation of the plan, the question is, what happens next? Can the gaming board somehow revive it unilaterally without the attorney general's permission?
Conditions having failed, remember, they were separate signatories, Your Honor. They had separate and independent obligations. And the gaming board had the sole obligation with regard to suitability review, for example. And the attorney general walked away, but the gaming board never did. And the gaming board came in and said, despite knowing of the failure of the conditions, they embraced the plan. Under the SaferSlack case and other authority we cite, that waived those conditions. And they went beyond that. They then issued a formal resolution right after the confirmation of the plan in which they formally waived those conditions, and then they issued a new letter agreement on August 2nd, 2004, which repeated verbatim the three key obligations they had undertaken to assume a year and a half before in what we call the December 15 letter agreement, which is Exhibit B to the plan. And by doing so, they formally and finally, remember, this became a final order. No one appealed it. No one challenged it. It became a final order. And it's different from your Latin Kings example because it's a discrete, single piece of litigation, the disciplinary proceeding.
Why do you think that property rights of the strength that you're arguing can be found in licenses that are conditioned on, among other things, the police power?
Well, the property, I mean, licenses have been
You're
recognized.
You're saying that there's a property right that's created as soon as the gaming board comes to this August decision that can't then be changed in any way by a later gaming board, which, of course, as we all know, is what happened.
Well, the license is plainly a piece of property. It's a regulated piece of property, but it falls within the in rem jurisdiction
bankruptcy court. Of course it does. No, but of course there's property and property. There are permit, you know, a grazing permit would be property for
sure.
A bankruptcy proceeding, and yet if Congress decides the next day to revoke the grazing permit, it can do so. It hasn't promised the kind of durational property protection, if you will, that Blackacre has. You know, there are permits, there are all these things, and this particular license was subject to the regulatory power of the gaming board.
And
the
would question continue
is, can the gaming board at any time, for disciplinary reasons, can a new gaming board change what an old gaming board has done?
In the abstract, it might be able to, but recall here you had a piece of ongoing litigation.
Why
which had
that
been
matter?
Dormant because states and other entities can settle litigation. They can resolve litigation that initially began under the police power, and the final resolution of that closes it. And that's what happened through this plan. If you look at the disclosure statement, which is in the supplemental appendix the state filed, it says that the plan results in a settlement, and that is why the state is getting a payment. This was a settlement of litigation. It's also, recall, Your Honor, there was not a police power reason why they resumed the disciplinary proceeding. We don't know why. They've never said. They simply
You don't think the ALJ and the board's orders reveal why they resumed it?
There is nothing in the ALJ's orders or the board's findings which has anything which occurred after the date of the confirmation of this plan. The gaming board knew of all of these things at the time. It agreed to accept a huge state payment. And again, recall that this is not a payment the state would be entitled to, Your Honor. This is a payment the state bargained for of several hundred million dollars, which would ordinarily have gone to the shareholders of Emerald. This was property that under the law of bankruptcy would belong to them, but as part of the bankruptcy process, they were ceding to the state.
You know, that fact is one I've thought about, but in my mind, it seems to suggest that the state was acting for neutral reasons. It was going to get money if it revoked the license. It was going to get money if it didn't revoke the license.
Not as much, Your Honor. Oh. It's getting everything here, and it's creating a forfeiture for creditors. Creditors now will get nothing. That's not disputed.
Right. No,
the plan will be destroyed. That's not disputed.
Right.
The race is removed from bankruptcy court jurisdiction. This is why the Katz case from the Supreme Court of a couple weeks ago is so important, because that says you can't have that happen. We've turned things upside down.
But the question is, what was the race? Because, of course, bankruptcy can't give you more property rights than you had before.
It can't.
If this license was subject to revocation at any moment for, say, mob connections or something.
Well, and of course it would remain subject to revocation, Your Honor, after they went through the process.
Why are they precluded before?
Because they agreed in the confirmation hearing that the plan better accomplished their police power goals than did revocation. And there's been no reason why they backed off that finding. But if under the plan they agree to a process the state had the discretion and power to undertake, which was they would do suitability review of Isle. Isle's been found suitable 50 times in 17 jurisdictions. But if it weren't found suitable, they had the right then to proceed to Midwest Gaming. And if Midwest Gaming were found unsuitable, and again, they had the power to make that determination, then they could auction it off to the highest bidder. But when they did that, Rosemont would still get paid under the plan. Creditors would still get paid under the plan. It's a mechanism which meshed federal plan interests, confirming a bankruptcy plan, resolving creditors' issues with state police power issues. What you have is an unmeshing in which the state, for non-police power reasons, has seized the race, caused a forfeiture, and done so for no new police power reasons, and in doing so has breached a settlement agreement. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Goroff. We'll hear now from Mr. Huzza.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, counsel for the defendants appellees, and I urge the Court to affirm the lower court's dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint in this case on the ground that it does not, as the plaintiff claims, state a valid federal right and cause of action to enjoin the disciplinary proceeding or interfere with its operation or to require the defendants to conduct a suitability review. It's important to note that the state in this case was not acting in the capacity of some typical creditor in a bankruptcy, but rather...
But Mr. Hussig, as Mr. Gorf points out, the net result of what the state has done in this case is to give the state of Illinois a lot more money than it would have had the state not resumed proceeding.
That may be the case, but of course the state was entitled to all of that money under the law in effect at the time, and the plan contemplated an arrangement under which the state might forbear from pursuing that as an alternative to getting all of the proceeds from a reissuance of the license, that it would get some less share of the proceeds. But that doesn't mean that its dealings with the debtor towards that alternative scenario turned it into a creditor. It was simply acting in furtherance of its regulatory goals, saying, all right, if it's the view of a majority of the board members at this time that we can further those goals through this arrangement contemplated by the plan without being bound by it, that doesn't make them somehow subject to a duty to fulfill that condition to the effectiveness of the plan, and nor does it freeze in time some policy view of those members of the board so that no future board could take contrary action. They didn't put their policy regulatory powers in handcuffs by virtue of anything that happened here, and certainly nothing that would create a federal law right to prevent them from continuing to exercise those regulatory functions.
What would have happened if, counterfactually, the administrative law judge and then the board had concluded that nothing wrong had happened, that the disciplinary proceeding had taken place, that Emerald had been fully exonerated, everybody had been exonerated? Would the plan stand at that point, or what?
I think that in those circumstances, it's a scenario that wasn't contemplated by the plan, because the plan sort of expected that the disciplinary proceeding would not go forward and that there would be a suitability review. Whether Emerald would be bound under the plan vis-a-vis the other parties to the plan, not the state, nonetheless to go forward with a transfer of a sale of its business and corresponding interest in its license, subject to the suitability review of the state, is I think, an interesting question. But
well, the reason I'm asking is because if the disciplinary proceeding is real, if it's not just some kangaroo court, you know, designed to come to a predetermined conclusion, then presumably the gaming board would have something to do if it turned out that there was nothing there to discipline.
Oh, absolutely. And ultimately, I think it's fair to say, based upon the exhaustive record by the careful findings by Administrative Law Judge Abner Mikva and the extensive decision of the Gaming Board itself, the evidence was massive. This was not some sham proceeding, notwithstanding the conclusory characterizations and unfounded ones to the contrary by the plaintiff in this case. The disciplinary proceeding was a live proceeding, and to the extent that I think this goes to the issue of what the individual gaming board members testified at the confirmation hearing. The suggestion was made that they declared that they had the power to control the disciplinary proceeding. A careful review of that transcript shows that, apart from the fact that these were individual IGB members, not the IGB itself, which was not a party to the proceeding, was not present in the proceeding, these members were subpoenaed. A fourth member was not subpoenaed. There was no notice of a meeting or anything of the like. But they never said that they had the ultimate authority to compromise the disciplinary proceeding in the face of the Attorney General's clear claim that under long-established Illinois law, which I think has continued even more recently in the Illinois Supreme Court's decisions in the Lyons versus Ryan case and the Scicchiti case in this past term, they have said that when it comes to representing the interests of the people of the state of Illinois, the Attorney General has the absolute constitutional power in civil matters to call the shots, not the agency. And this may
is
be an unusual...
Is this an issue this court has to resolve, you know, whether it is in fact the Illinois Gaming Board or the Attorney General with the final say?
I think not. And likewise, I think the court does not even need to address the sovereign immunity issues that are lurking in the background, because the ground relied upon by the district court in affirming below was that Rosemont has pitched its claim on the theory that it has a federal law right to obtain the relief that it seeks here. And if there is no such federal law right, that's the end of the question. That's the end of the story. They have unambiguously represented in front of the bankruptcy court, in front of the district court, and again in front of this court that it is seeking to enforce purely federal law rights. And if it has none, then there is no need to address this sort of third-tier relevant issue about who ultimately holds the high trump card in determining the outcome of litigation in this case.
But you know what's troublesome about this, of course, which your opponents point out, is that everybody spends a lot of time, you know, negotiating and thinking about the structure of this plan and figuring out what the relationship is going to be between the suitability determinations of a possible alternative holder of the license and the disciplinary proceeding, and on and on and on it goes. And then all of a sudden the rug gets pulled out from everybody when the membership of the board changes.
Well, I wouldn't say that the rug got pulled out. They all went into this with their eyes wide open. It was clear, and the bankruptcy court essentially agreed, that there was no ability by the court to constrain the gaming board's exercise of its regulatory functions or the attorney general's power, both contractually under the first side letter and constitutionally, to insist that the disciplinary proceeding go forward, not to decide the ultimate outcome of it after a complete trial. And so they went in saying, okay, we can't stop that proceeding from going forward. Nobody's committing to predetermine the outcome of that at the end of the trial, but the current majority of the members of the gaming board have the current policy view, a position that they expressed under subpoena at the confirmation hearing, that they desired to pursue this alternative scenario. That became, in effect, not an obligation of the plan in any sense, but instead a condition to effectiveness and success of the plan. And Emerald's, the debtor's own disclosure statement going in said, we are not going to be able to bind the gaming board. We don't try and game the gaming board, but that's not a requirement to find feasibility. That's not a requirement for confirmation. So this is going to be done taking the chance that the gaming board is going to act in conformity with what the present intentions expressed by a majority of the board are. If that doesn't happen, as Judge Weedoff said, everybody went into this knowing that there was a risk that that position might change. And, in fact, when there was a change in the membership of the board, that's exactly what Judge Weedoff predicted. That's exactly what happened. And for somebody to cry foul and say that the rug got pulled out from under them is untenable as a factual matter.
But, of course, it does make it a lot of wasted time. It essentially turns into a zero-asset estate, right, without the license.
And I think there's nothing about bankruptcy law that's offended by that. Bankruptcy law doesn't require that a plan be successful at all costs. That is certainly not by creating some expansion of the property rights of the debtor by nullifying or eviscerating state regulatory powers that are a condition on that license in the first place. And that's essentially what the plaintiff is asking for in this case, is that the state's regulatory powers be nullified, because that will expand the property rights of the debtor and all the creditors will then benefit financially. But that's not within the purview of the bankruptcy court to do that, and that's not something that the bankruptcy court said it was doing. It's something that all the parties at the time agreed and understood that it was not doing. So what the fallback position of the plaintiff in this case is that by subsequent actions, you know, leave aside for a moment the testimony of the individual members of the gaming board, and I think we've sort of dealt with that one pretty effectively, is that by this subsequent
resolution, the
July 28, 2004 resolution and the August 2nd letter, and I think a careful examination of those show that they do not rise to the level of creating some federal law right to enforceable by a bankruptcy court to insist that the gaming board compromise or dismiss the disciplinary proceeding and not go forward with it.
To what extent is it relevant for us to look at the actual charges that the disciplinary proceeding was dealing with?
I don't think beyond just satisfying yourselves that those are a police power regulatory charges as opposed to some pretextual attempt to try and advance some pecuniary benefit that would fall outside the police power functions that are recognized by the bankruptcy code. And of course, that's an issue that was already decided in prior litigation, and Judge Weedoff found that it was entitled to collateral estoppel effect not only against Emerald but also against Rosemont, who was an interventor in that proceeding. He found that this was not an attempt to advance some pecuniary benefit, either at its inception or even thereafter. And ultimately, as long as the court can remain satisfied that the state was exercising its police power functions, not indirectly trying to advance the interests of itself or its citizens as creditors of the debtor, and that is not the case, then I think that's really all the court needs to look at. Let me address, if I may, some of the specifics of the supposed resolution in the second Cy letter, and I believe that that should satisfy the court that there is no federal law right created by virtue of those. The second Cy letter couldn't become a part of the plan, as Judge St. Eve ruled, because any modification of the plan would require satisfaction of Bankruptcy Code Section 1127 that was never done here. So if the plan itself as originally adopted didn't impose such an obligation, and the second side letter or the resolution couldn't become a part of the plan, then we're getting outside of the scope of the bankruptcy court's Section 1141 enforcement powers.
Opponents are hanging their hats on actual language in the plan that says subsequent documents, maybe I'm paraphrasing a bit, that are necessary for carrying out the purpose of this plan also have to be enforced.
No. What it says is that the court retains whatever jurisdiction given and authority given to it by the bankruptcy code and the judicial code to enforce documents entered into in connection with a plan. That doesn't make it a part of the plan. And to the extent that we're talking about a federal law right for enforcement of the provisions of the plan, that doesn't mean that any document ever entered into in connection with a plan somehow becomes a part of the plan. 1127 clearly would trump that theory. And it's not a – that language in sections 11.7 and 11.8 of the plan don't sweep into the scope of the plan any such document. They merely confirm to the extent that the bankruptcy court would have authority to do so. And I think that's a separate question, to what extent it can expand its Section 1334 jurisdiction. But even within those limits, that's just a jurisdictional statement. It's not a definition of the scope of the plan itself.